The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am your hometown girl, Shadate Hargett Hill, with the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Connect to Success. For the next half hour, I will share articles with you from BrailleWorks.com, NPR.org, and CBSSports.com. Let's get started. From the NPR.org website, deafblind athlete quits Team USA after she's told she can't bring a care assistant. Becca Myers, a swimmer seen as a favorite to bring gold home from Tokyo, has canceled plans to compete in the Paralympics after being told she can't bring a personal care assistant to Japan. Myers is deaf and blind. U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, USOPC, officials say they don't have space for her to bring an aide because of coronavirus restrictions on athletic delegations. Quote, I've had to make the gut-wrenching decision to withdraw from the Tokyo 2020 Paralympics, Myers said Tuesday in a statement posted on her Facebook page. I'm angry, I'm disappointed, but most of all, I'm sad to not be representing my country, end quote. Myers, 26, says officials have not taken her and other athletes' needs into account. She won 3 gold medals at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Paralympics, but the experience also left her deeply shaken. In strange new surroundings, she struggled to accomplish essential tasks on her own, such as finding the athlete's dining hall. Since then, her mother, Maria Myers, has accompanied her at competitions as a personal care assistant. But after being told her mother can't join her in Tokyo, Myers opted out. She says, I would love to go to Tokyo, she told the Washington Post, which first reported her withdrawal. Swimming has given me my identity as a person. I've always been Becca the swimmer girl. I haven't taken this lightly. This has been very difficult for me, but I need to say something to effect change because this can't go on any longer. All signs had been pointing to Myers turning in a special performance in Tokyo. She has set new world records in recent years. Last month, she was celebrating dominance at the Paralympic trials, where she secured a spot on Team USA. Tokyo was set to be her third Paralympics. Myers, who was born with Usher syndrome, has thrived at sports elite level. Because of the genetic disorder, she is deaf and is aided by cochlear implants. She often relies on lip reading, but her eyesight continues to deteriorate, and because everyone in Tokyo will be wearing masks, her ability to understand others would be hampered. Rick Adams, the USOPC's Chief of Sport Performance and National Governing Body Services, has told the Myers family, while he empathizes with them, Tokyo organizers have limited delegations to athletes and essential staff. The USOPC told Myers that the 34 athletes on the Paralympic swim team would be supported by one dedicated personal care assistant, PCA, along with 6 coaches. Nearly a third of the swimmers are visually impaired, according to Myers. The Myers family says the situation is untenable and must change. They also believe the USOPC has held firm on its position to avoid a rush of athletes attempting to add their own PCAs to the delegation. Myers, who lives in a suburb between Baltimore and Washington, D.C., has been training with the nation's Capital Swim Club, which launched the Olympic careers of stars such as Katie Ledecky and Tom Dolan. There, Myers has trained under famed coach Bruce Gimmel. Your heart just breaks for her, Gimmel told the Post. It seems to me if our focus is athletes first, which it should be, but which it isn't always, if athletes first is what we're doing, then we as a USPOC, we need to do better. We must do better. Becca has been forced to make a decision that no Paralympian should ever have to make, and Speedo fully supports her choice, the swimwear company said in a statement sent to NPR. It added that it will continue to stand alongside Becca and support her journey in all that makes her an inspiring role model for the next generation of swimmers. Becca spoke more about her opinions in an opinion piece that I'm going to read from USA Today. She says, when I made my first trip out in public to a store since the pandemic began, it was late 2020. With my trusted guide dog, Birdie, I nervously walked into the Apple store near where I live. I had been there many times before, but COVID-19 changed everything. Everyone was wearing masks, which inhibits my ability to read lips. The store layout had changed, which made it difficult for Birdie and me to get around. As a deafblind person who was born with Usher syndrome, a condition affecting both hearing and vision, I am used to being forced to become comfortable in uncomfortable surroundings. That's part of the deal. And that's what makes my decision to withdraw from the upcoming Tokyo 2020 Paralympics so incredibly difficult. The Paralympic Games are supposed to be a haven for athletes with disabilities, the one place where we are able to compete on a level playing field with all amenities, protections, and support systems in place. After COVID-19 put last year's games in Tokyo on pause, we all expected and were forced to deal with the reality that this summer's Paralympic Games will be altered in many ways. But then I learned this summer that U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee denied a reasonable and essential accommodation for me to be able to compete at the games. Since 2017, the USOPC has approved the use of a personal care assistant whom I know and trust to be with at international swim meets because of my disabilities, but not this year. With health and safety of the utmost importance at the games this year, rightfully so, the USOPC denied my request on the basis of COVID-19 restrictions imposed by the Japanese government. This just doesn't add up. I strongly believe the reduction in staff was not intended to reduce the number of essential support staff for Paralympians like PCAs, but to reduce the number of non-essential staff. Athletes with disabilities are able to compete in a setting like the Paralympics because of PCAs. They help us navigate these foreign venues from the pool deck, athlete check-in, to finding where we can eat. But the biggest support they provide athletes like myself is giving us the ability to trust our surroundings, to feel at home for the short time we're in this new, unfamiliar environment. I have repeatedly been told that I do not need my PCA, whom I know and trust. The USOPC informed athletes that there would be a single PCA on staff available to assist me when needed. But this PCA is also responsible for being on call for 33 other members of the Paralympic swim team. There are 8 remaining visually impaired athletes competing on the swim team alone, yet not one person on the swim staff is specifically certified to work with blind or visually impaired athletes. How could I possibly set foot in a foreign city with the numerous restrictions and barriers that COVID-19 has put up and expect to feel safe for 2 weeks? How can any of us? This isn't the first time that I have been let down by the USOPC. At the 2016 Paralympic Games in Rio, I was crippled with fear and anxiety before a competition even began. Surprisingly, no one of the 2016 U.S. Paralympic swimming staff was prepared to care for a deaf-blind athlete. I was overwhelmed navigating the athlete's village, finding the bus terminal, making my way to the venues where I needed to compete. I had such issues in and around the dining hall where I wasn't able to find the right food to eat that I started skimping on meals. I reached out to the mental health professional on staff to help, but learned she was off campus and wasn't set to return to the athlete's village until the night before competition began. The situation got so bad that the head of coach of the U.S. Paralympic swimming, Queen Nichols, decided I needed to be removed from the village and stay with my parents at a nearby hotel to get out of a potentially dangerous situation and properly prepare. In that moment, I promised myself that I would never be put in that situation again. Yet here we are. Every single Paralympian has earned the right on this team to compete for our country. The Paralympic movement has never been a bigger platform on the world stage than it is going to have this summer. Advertisers, brands, and networks are all celebrating athletes with disabilities, showcasing us breaking barriers, defining odds, overcoming adversity. What you don't see, though, is that many of those barriers and adverse situations are being created by our own Paralympic structure. What happens if there is an emergency in the middle of the night? What if we need to be moved from one venue to another quickly? Masks and distancing have made it incredibly difficult for me to make out what people are doing or saying. If I don't have someone I can trust, how can I trust that I will be safe? I did not make this decision on a whim. It was agonizing. I have trained for 5 years to get back to this point. I know my chances to swim for my country are coming to an end, but enough is enough. I need to speak up for the next athlete who is deaf, blind, or disabled in another way. As Paralympians, we train as hard as our counterparts, the Olympians. We deserve the same quality and safety nets that our able-bodied teammates receive. I have the Olympic rings tattooed on the back of my rib cage. That means something to me. It also should mean something to the country I swim for. Becca Myers is a 2-time U.S. Paralympic swimmer. She has won 3 gold medals, 2 silvers, and a bronze. A native of Maryland, Myers was born deaf with a progressive sight loss due to Usher syndrome type 1. The Tokyo Paralympics will start on August 24th and run through September 5th. Although Becca is not participating, she is still one who continues to inspire and break down barriers every day. Speaking of the upcoming Paralympics, the Industries for the Blind and Visually Impaired website, IBVI.org, compiled a list of 5 of the most well-known visually impaired athletes and their stories. As a legally blind marathon runner, Marla Runyon has won 3 national championships in the women's 5,000 meters. Most notably, she became the first legally blind athlete to participate in the Olympics at the 2000 Sydney Olympics, where she placed 8th in the 1500 meter, the highest finish by an American woman at that event. On May 25, 2001, Eric Weinmeier became the first blind person to reach the summit of Mount Everest, an achievement which was profiled in the Time magazine and covered in his autobiography, Touch the Top of the World, A Blind Man's Journey to Climb Farther Than the Eye Can See. Eric maintains an active lifestyle as an acrobat, skydiver, long-distance biker, marathon runner, skier, mountaineer, ice climber, and rock climber. Paralympic Hall of Fame swimmer Tricia Jorn is a U.S. swimmer who has been blind since birth. Most notably, she has won 55 medals, 41 gold, 9 silver, and 5 bronze, making her the most successful athlete in the history of the Paralympic Games. Craig McFarlane lost his vision at age 2.5 during a welding accident. His athletics instinct kicked in at an early age, and by age 8, he had won his first wrestling tournament. Inspired by this achievement, Craig went on to compete in a wide variety of sports and earned a whopping 103 gold medals in wrestling, track and field, swimming, snow skiing, water skiing, and golfing. Growing up, Craig Acoin was always active in sports. Upon losing his sight at age 16, he turned to sports as a way to regain his confidence and independence. Craig has now participated in 7 triathlons and has completed a bicycle trek across Canada. Other notable blind and visually impaired athletes include climber Steve Bate, gold ball player Lisa Banta, judo gold medalist Anthony Clark, golfer Zohar Sharan, marathon runner Henry Wayoki, and swimmer Chris Holmes, to name just a few. As the ever-inspiring Robert Hensel once said, "I choose not to place a diss in my ability." Now, article from the USABA.org, Gold Ball Game Time with John Cusco. John Cusco was a member of the silver medal winning U.S. men's gold ball team at the Rio 2016 Paralympic Games and is headed to Tokyo to represent Team USA once again. By day, he is a high school math and physics teacher with a background in music. Here are the Q&A questions. How did you initially get involved in gold ball? I have a degenerative hereditary eye disease called retinitis pigmentosa, or RP. It causes me to have tunnel vision and night blindness. I was diagnosed with a vision problem at around 6 months old and with RP at 4 years old. When I was younger, my vision was better and I was able to keep up with my peers in most things without any accommodations. In middle school, that changed. My peers got better and faster and my vision got worse. Gold ball was the perfect outlet for me, physically and socially. I found a game to play competitively, and I found a social group to connect with. I met many people who were not afraid to acknowledge their blindness, use a cane, ask for help, and do the things they wanted to do, even if it made other people uncomfortable. I cannot express how much self-confidence I gained from experiencing the world of gold ball. Due to my vision impairment, any game that I play with people who have normal vision puts me at an immediate disadvantage. No matter how hard I practice, I cannot be great when I am in that situation. On the other hand, in gold ball, since all players wear blackout ski goggles, vision is not a factor. The more I play gold ball and the more work I put into training, the better I can be. I have no physical limit to the greatness I can achieve. I was first exposed to gold ball playing in Detroit area youth tournaments, which were run by teacher consultants for children who were blind or visually impaired. I also attended the Michigan Blind Athletics Association sports education camp at Western Michigan University. That camp consists of 4 days of training and competition in many different sports. In 1998, I was selected to the Michigan gold ball team to compete at the Youth Nationals in Florida. Since then, I have been traveling the U.S. and Canada playing about 5 tournaments each year. In 2009, I was selected to be part of the USA team and have subsequently traveled internationally to compete. I have played in Canada, the USA, Mexico, Brazil, Spain, Belgium, Sweden, Poland, Lithuania, Turkey, Finland, Peru, and soon Japan. What's your athletic background? I have been playing gold ball in the USA and Canada tournaments since 1999, so my athletic background is mostly just gold ball. In the late 2000s, I ran the Detroit Marathon twice and the Boston Marathon twice with a best time of 3 hours and 40 minutes. Can you tell us about your days as a musician? I started with piano lessons when I was a first grader. I switched to trumpet in the 5th grade and took private lessons from then until college. I would also add that my mother and I were always singing around the house and on choir rides, so most days were also a vocal lesson. In high school, I played in symphonic, jazz, and marching band, ending as the section leader and first chair player my senior year. At Western Michigan University, I continued to play trumpet in the Bronco marching band every fall and the concert band every spring. I also became the section leader in the marching band for my fourth and fifth years. Many people would ask how one does marching band with no peripheral vision, and I would say, I don't know. Mostly I spent a lot of time and effort memorizing and practicing. What did it mean to you to represent the U.S. at the Rio 2016 Paralympic Games? It is hard to find words to express what it was like to play for USA at the 2016 Rio Paralympics. So many conflicting emotions hit me after every single game. I walked off the court in tears every time. I was also very overcome with emotion during the entry parade for the opening ceremony, and I anticipate that happening again for Tokyo. The support and hope sent from Americans back home is felt very keenly. Do you have a favorite gold ball memory? I struggle with absolutes, but one favorite gold ball memory of mine was saluting the crowd with the Lithuanian team after our pool play match in Rio in 2016. There were about 7,000 people in the stands, and the game was very high-powered and close with a final score of 9-8. After we shook hands with the other team, we all went to the sideline and held up our hands to the ground. I happened to be the U.S. player on the end, and the Lithuanian coach reached over and grabbed my hand. So we had a complete chain of all USA players and coaches with all of the Lithuanian coaches and players. It was truly a moment of international sportsmanship and represents what the Paralympics are all about. Can you tell about your family and the support you receive from them? My family that I live with is my wife, Jessica, and son, George. Jessica is a teacher of children who are blind and visually impaired for the schools in Western Wayne County, Michigan. George is a third grade student at Glengarry Elementary School in Commerce Township, Michigan. We love to spend time together doing Star Wars stuff and also in the pool or at the beach up north near Alpena, Michigan. We live in a beautiful neighborhood with a ton of trees and a lake down the street. An enormous state forest is less than a mile away. After school, I meet George at the bus stop and we walk home together. When we get home, we have a snack and then do something fun like swim in the pool or play Legos. Jessica usually joins us and eventually we get around to dinner. Jessica always prepares the meal and I do the dishes. My brother Talon is a teller at a credit union in St. Clair Shores, Michigan. He is the most creative person I have ever known. Both of my parents have passed on within the past 7 years from cancer. My mother, Julianne, was a sales service manager for Universal Container Corporations in Ferndale, Michigan. She was a giant caregiver, and I was her pride and joy. She was so proud of all of my accomplishments. My father, Alton, was a tool maker for Carbaloy in Warren, Michigan. He was the most strong-willed person I ever known. When he was 48 years old, after smoking cigarettes for 30 years, he quit cold turkey without regrets. He was always there to drive me to practice of all kinds. Both of my parents worked for the Big Three auto industry for their entire careers. Growing up near Detroit had a huge impact on me and my wife's upbringing. George is one of my prime motivators. In many ways, his excitement for my elite gold ball competitions motivates me to set lofty goals and train hard. When he watched me process into the opening ceremony for the Paralympic Games in Rio 2016 on national television, I and my extended family absorbed his excitement, and I often think about his reaction to that moment to get me through hard training. On the other hand, I plan my training and competitions as much as possible around George's schedule. I am able to squeeze in my daily workouts between getting home from work at 3:15 and getting George off of his bus at 4:30. Fortunately for me, George loves to come to goal ball practice and travel to goal ball tournaments to watch me play and see the goal ball guys. I receive so much help from my friends, family, and my family's wife that it is impossible for me to list everything that they have done to help me on my goal ball journey. Countless car rides to bus stations, airports, practices, and back and forth to Fort Wayne taking care of my son George when I am away, becoming goal ball referees, assistants with hours of web research, and so much more. Outside of goal ball training, how do you spend your time? I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I read every issue of four magazines: Discover, National Geographic, Asmal Science Fiction, and Analog Science Fiction. I am always in the middle of reading at least two things at a time. My library consists mostly of nonfiction science and science fiction. While I write this, I am in the middle of a book teaching me Japanese and an issue of Analog, as well as the latest Stephen King novel. You have a master's degree in mathematics. Does that come in handy for the sport of goal ball? There is no specific knowledge from me advancing math degree that helps with goal ball, but through earning my degrees, I learned to think differently than most people. I consider most problems very analytically, and I spend a lot of time thinking about goal ball. As a result, I am constantly considering and evaluating everything about what I do and what we do as Team USA. Is there anything you like to share that our audience may not know, like favorite food, quirky talents, etc.? My favorite food is pan-fried eggplant. After slicing the eggplant thinly, run each slice through an egg wash and breadcrumbs before it hits the pan to become crispy on the outside. Also, I can whistle in three different ways. We've run out of time for today's episode of Connect to Success. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm your hometown girl, Shadate Hargett Hill, for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Connect to Success is available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. See you next time on the radio. Thank you.